Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The structure is there. It will be able to be rebuilt. There's certainly no question about your extensive work will be undertaken.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris on the aftermath of a catastrophic fire that engulfed the world-famous cathedral. Also ahead, we'll look at the Julian Assange case and what it means for press freedom. And UN aid agencies express deep concern for the safety of civilians in Tripoli. It's all on today's International Edition. The Paris Fire Brigade said today the structure of the famed Notre Dame Cathedral has been saved, along with the site's main works of art, after 400 firefighters spent more than 9 hours battling a fire that caused massive damage. The building's two iconic towers and stone structure were still standing today, but absent were the 12th century cathedral's roof and spire, which collapsed in the blaze. French President Emmanuel Macron told reporters at the cathedral shortly before midnight local time that he would launch a national fundraising campaign to rebuild the historic cathedral, and he urged the world's greatest talents to help. Hours later, two French billionaires pledged a total of $339 million for the reconstruction effort. Reporter Catherine Field covered the fire and spoke with me about the significance of one of the world's most beloved structures.
The structure is there. It will be able to be rebuilt. There's certainly no question about your extensive work will be undertaken. And really, it's just a matter of people coming to terms with something that perhaps a lot of Parisians had taken for granted as they'd cycled past each day or gone past on a bus. They'd always thought it would be there. But now everyone is walking past there and just remembering what an enormous part of our cultural heritage Notre Dame de Paris actually is.
Yes, and I'm sure just from that aspect of it, the significance of it, it has survived two world wars, it survived the French Revolution, it's survived pollution, and now this has happened. So really, what are some of the things people are saying? What's their reaction?
The reaction at first was complete disbelief. It was as though someone had just taken a stake and just rammed it through the heart of Paris. And Paris just could not believe it. And people that I was standing alongside and were watching it were just saying, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. And people started to say, oh, the tower is going to go, and they were crying. And as you rightly say, this cathedral has been there now for more than 800 years. It survived the revolution, it survived religious wars and the plague and Nazism. And people remember with enormous affection that moment in 1944 when Paris was liberated from the German occupation. And they knew it had been occupied because the bells of Notre Dame pealed out, that very deep sound that travels right across Paris and it sort of almost works its way up the Seine River. So it's part of Paris life, and it has been for centuries. And one forgets that hundreds of years ago, when the church was at its most powerful here in France, you would go to Notre Dame de Paris to get news, to find out about all sorts of municipal events, of what was happening around you. So that was a place of information, of exchanges as well. And even in those days, if you didn't go there for the mass, it was also right alongside the Seine. And that part of the Seine was where people would go and do their laundry. And so that is why in some of the more magnificent artworks you see from that period, you see washerwomen doing their laundry in the shadow of Notre Dame de Paris. So it's been part of life here for so long.
And also just looking at the timing, there's really no good time for anything like this to happen. However, this has happened during Holy Week, and Easter Sunday is coming up. So how is this going to affect that?
At this stage, officials are saying they just don't know, but I think they're very carefully trying to let the population know that perhaps there will be no services there during this Holy Week. What they're saying is it could be at least 48 hours from now before all of the forensic teams actually get to go inside of the cathedral to see what can be salvaged. But as you say, it's Holy Week. Some of the relics that are in the cathedral only come out during that Holy Week period, in particular the crown of thorns, which people believe was worn by Jesus of Nazareth when he was crucified. That comes out once a month, but it also comes out over the Easter period for pilgrims and religious people to go and view. So big question mark over that. And of course, that was another one of the aspects of being alongside Notre Dame de Paris as it was burning, because a lot of people had just come for this Holy Week period to be at what really is the center of the religious life in France, but as well, it's the center of life in France. If you're here in Paris, all roads, the distance are taken by Notre Dame. You're somewhere in Paris and it says you're 10 kilometers away from the center. The center is Notre Dame.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Well, federal lawyers say WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange and intelligence worker Chelsea Manning may have known the information they leaked would cause injury. The arrest of Assange in Britain raises difficult questions about freedom of the press in the United States. Press freedom groups say the U.S. government's action against Assange is an effort to punish him for leaking records. Assange is accused of working with Manning to release thousands of records of U.S. military actions against civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange is in prison waiting for a court's decision on whether he should be sent to the U.S. to face trial. American officials have charged Assange with conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. He could be sentenced to up to 5 years if convicted, but he does not face charges under U.S. espionage laws at this time. In addition, Assange could face unrelated sex charges in Sweden. To help us understand more about the case and what it means for freedom of the press, our colleague Mario Ritter spoke with Alexandra Ellerbeck, the North American Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The U.S. is bringing one charge against Assange. Can you tell us what it is and how it potentially threatens journalists?
So the U.S. is bringing a charge under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. At first blush, I think a lot of observers were very relieved that this was not an Espionage Act charge related to the publication itself of classified information. But I think we're still very concerned, and we're still very concerned for a number of reasons. One, there's no evidence that Assange actually succeeded in hacking anything. And it's also information that the Obama administration had and decided not to pursue.
Is it correct the charge relates to actually conspiracy?
It's related to a conspiracy to gain access to a password under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which criminalizes unauthorized access to computer databases. That action and what is alleged in the indictment falls outside of normal journalistic practice. Journalists don't help hack databases. They don't try to hack into passwords. But, you know, I think what is concerning to us is, one, just how flimsy the entire indictment is. And, you know, whatever the sort of base charges, the fact that the U.S. is bringing a case 9 years later about an unsuccessful attempt to figure out a password, it seems like that's not the heart of the issue. I think there's a very real concern that this is really because they're upset about what Assange published and they want to get back at him. And if that's the case, then we should all be concerned. So while the narrow issue of trying to figure out this password falls outside of normal journalistic activity, the indictment spends an incredible amount of time talking about the fact that Assange solicited information from his source, that he used encrypted messenger, going into the tools that he used and his general communications with his source. And all of that is sort of standard journalistic activity. And so the fact that the indictment sort of sweeps that into part of a broader conspiracy, I think, is very concerning.
WikiLeaks has been accused of not being balanced in the way it releases information. Do you think that could be used against Assange?
You know, I think that at the core of this is the question is not WikiLeaks practices or Assange's personal likability. It's the press freedom implications. You know, we've expressed concern about some of WikiLeaks practices, such as when WikiLeaks failed to redact names of a vulnerable journalist. We wish they would fully disclose financing and support. But at the core of this, it's not about that. It's about the broad press freedom implications, and it's about the precedent that this could set.
Alexandra Ellerbeck, North American Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And of course, that was Alexandra Ellerbeck from the North American Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. While United Nations aid agencies are expressing deep concern for the safety of civilians in Tripoli as fighting moves closer to the center of the Libyan capital, troops fighting for renegade General Khalifa Haftar began their battle to seize Tripoli on April 5th. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies are particularly worried about the situation of some 4,000 refugees and migrants, most from sub-Saharan Africa, who are held in government detention centers in and around Tripoli. Of particular concern are more than 1,500 believed to be trapped in several places of detention close to where the clashes are occurring. UN Refugee Agency spokeswoman Liz Throssell tells VOA her agency is in contact with Libyan authorities, working to guarantee the safety of those detained near the combat zones.
This includes advocating with the authorities to allow the relocation of vulnerable individuals to the gathering and departure center. As you can imagine, this is complicated by the severely restricted access amid this security situation. And to date, we have facilitated relocation of about 150 vulnerable refugees from the Ain Zara detention center.
Throssell says the UNHCR has set up a hotline for refugees and internally displaced people stuck in areas of conflict seeking assistance. She says her agency has transferred medicine and medical equipment to the Ministry of Health. This is to support emergency units and hospitals around Tripoli. The World Health Organization reports the number of people killed since the conflict erupted April 5th now stands at 174, including 14 civilians. More than 750 have been wounded. Despite the dangerous security situation, the International Organization for Migration reports one bit of good news. It says it was able to organize a humanitarian relief flight Monday to repatriate 136 migrants to Nigeria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Among the top stories in the world, a Kremlin spokesman confirms that preparations are underway for a North Korea-Russia summit. Thousands of state employees in Turkey accused of supporting the Kurdish insurgency have lost their jobs, forcing many to make radical career changes. And a Chinese woman charged with lying to illegally enter U.S. President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago club is being held without bond. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
There is clothing that can help cool you down on hot days. And of course, there are a number of clothing options for keeping warm on colder days. Now, researchers at the University of Maryland say they have developed a new fabric that not only can cool or warm, but can automatically sense conditions to determine which mode to activate. On hot days, the fabric opens up and allows body heat to escape. On cold days, it limits the amount of heat that is allowed to pass through it, allowing the body to retain heat. The researchers say their new fabric is made with a special yarn that consists of fibers of two different synthetic materials. The yarn is then coated with carbon nanotubes, which is considered to be a unique type of lightweight and conductive metal. The developers admit that more research must be conducted before the fabric can be made available commercially. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, it has been less than a week since the Sudanese military ousted President Omar al-Bashir and replaced him with a military general who was himself forced to resign within a day. Meanwhile, protesters continue to gather at Sudan's military headquarters demanding an immediate transition to civilian rule. To find out more about the current situation in Sudan and the potential role of the international community in addressing the crisis, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Eric Cohen, co-founder of Act for Sudan, an alliance of American citizens and Sudanese living in the U.S. advocating for peace and justice in Sudan. Cohen began their conversation by saying he was cautiously optimistic.
Optimistic because what we're seeing now is the beginning of changes that we've hoped for and worked for Sudan for a very long time. But I'm guarded because the military has not turned over control to a civilian government, and that's a very, very important change because without it, there's the risk that Sudan devolves once again into a military dictatorship.
One wonders how much power the Sudanese protesters will actually be able to exert in the absence of vigorous support by the West and the African Union and the others.
It is only because of action by the Sudanese people rising up in large numbers that we've been able to see this change. International actors such as the United States, the European Union, the African Union can be helpful in insisting that the military council give up power to a civilian government. They could be harmful if they start helping the military government stay in place. So it's very important that international actors stay on the right side of this, but it's only because of action by the Sudanese themselves that we've seen this progress. It's not because of political parties. It's not because of the armed movements. Those all have helped, but it was ordinary civil society doing its job, rising up in large numbers against this terrible NCP regime. And if they continue the pressures that they've shown themselves capable of, beginning in December, and then especially through the large demonstrations on April 6th, that's exactly the kind of pressure that's going to make the difference.
Of course, from the protesters' point of view, America's track record and that of the Europeans as well is not so great. They have a huge history of propping up Bashir and his military. I wonder if realpolitik will assert itself as the clock runs out and they'll be in a bad face with regards to the protesters.
It would be very disappointing if that happened, but so far the signals in general are good. You may have seen the statement from the Troika powers, that is the U.S., the U.K., and Norway, who've been so active insisting that the military turn over power to the civilians. And we've heard that the United States has frozen its engagement plan with the government of Sudan. It's not pursuing that anymore. It's waiting for power to be turned over to a civilian government. On the other hand, I was distressed to see that the Charge d'Affaires for the United States in Khartoum just met with the head of the Rapid Support Forces, Hemeti. And that man has a tremendous amount of blood on his hands for his operations, particularly in Darfur, in the last few years. So that's concerning, but we'll see how this plays out.
That was Eric Cohen, co-founder of Act for Sudan, a U.S.-based coalition of organizations advocating for peace and justice in Sudan. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Well, an independent human rights body in Pakistan expressed grave concern at the state of human rights in the country. At the launch of its 2018 report yesterday, the rights body called for an immediate redressal of the issues it has highlighted. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan expressed concern over what it said were massive violations of human rights in Pakistan last year. The report cited unprecedented curbs on freedom of expression, intimidation of journalists and human rights activists, and restrictions on their freedom of movement, assembly, or association. The HRCP said minorities continued to face violence, abductions, and forced conversions to Islam. In addition, modern-day slavery affected 3 million people, while poverty forced millions of children to leave school and work instead. The HRCP Secretary General Haris Khalik said the report offered an opportunity to focus on the real issues.
I think it is very useful within the country, for policymakers to actually see where the real issues are. And Pakistan is also signatory to international covenants and protocols and conventions. And so it is important that this is all monitored, that whether we are living up to the promises, the commitments that we have made to larger humanity.
The HRCP also noted that Pakistan continued to ignore requests for country visits from UN special rapporteurs to monitor human rights conditions. The government has not responded to the findings of the report. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
Thank you, Aisha. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how has the foreign policy of the United States shaped its relationship with African countries? Former U.S. ambassadors reflect on the opportunities and challenges that Africa poses for the U.S. on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Need a little Straight Talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Well, after 5 years and two failed rescue missions, an Australian grandmother has been reunited with her three surviving grandchildren and two great-grandchildren in a refugee camp in northeast Syria. They were taken by their Australian parents to the Middle East in 2014 to join the group calling itself Islamic State. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
From her home in suburban Sydney, Karen Nettleton has for years tried to free her grandchildren from their nightmare in Syria. They were orphaned in the conflict and are living in a Kurdish-controlled refugee camp after fleeing Baghouz, the Islamic State's final stronghold. 17-year-old Zainab has two children of her own and is expecting another. Two of her brothers were killed in an airstrike alongside their father, Khaled Sharouf, a notorious Islamic State fighter who infamously posted a picture of his young son holding up a severed head in the city of Raqqa. In 2005, Sharouf pleaded guilty to preparing an act of terrorism in Australia and was jailed for 4 years. He would later leave the country on his brother's passport. His wife Tara, a convert to Islam, died from intestinal problems in the war zone. Australian authorities have told Karen Nettleton her grandchildren will soon be released into her care.
Well, the government has said that they will provide all of those, like the de-radicalisation and any assistance that we need in getting the children back into society. They'll help us do that. And they're not a threat or a danger to anyone. They're not.
It's unclear, however, how long it will take to repatriate the children, who say they were desperate to escape life under Islamic militants. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says his government wants to help them return home.
Where there are particularly children, then we are working with the Red Cross that where they're in a position for people to get to a place where they might be in a position to return to Australia, then we will cooperate with that process.
Nettleton's story has been documented by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She'd previously flown to Turkey twice to try to rescue the children, but was forced to return empty-handed. It's estimated there are 70 children born to Australian citizens in refugee camps, which are holding tens of thousands of wives and children of Islamic State fighters. Campaigners argue the children are the victims of horrific decisions made by their parents and must be allowed home. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil, and you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.